Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Theology on Tuesday. We're so glad that you're here. You already have taken a seat. This is probably a record on the steps that I've ever seen. I don't know how many. I can't do the math. But thank you for taking...
Thank you for going all the way up there.
Right.
Y'all look like on a different floor.
That's right. The VIP section right there. Well, good evening. My name is Justin. This is Brian. We're delighted that you're here. Theology on Tuesday. If this is your first time, welcome. You'll see these sheets that are scattered around the room. They're really important for how the evening goes. You can submit any question whatsoever to us at any point, related or unrelated to our conversation this evening. The way you can submit a question is by scanning this top QR code. And last time, I don't know what happened, but we fixed it, I believe. We tested it out. It should be good to go. This top QR code will be the way that you can submit any question. If you see a question that you find interesting, go ahead and uptick that, and Mims is going to be submitting those questions this evening. If you want to be on our email list and just kind of have reminders of when we meet, it's usually every other Tuesday, but sometimes we do some interesting things outside of this time, or the dates are slightly off. You can go ahead and join our email list, bottom left QR code there. Also, I believe Alexandra and Meredith, where are... Yeah,
there's Meredith.
There's Meredith. I don't know if Alexandra's here. But anyways, you should talk to them if you're interested in doing anything outside of this Theology on Tuesday's time, because we have a group called Holy City Life, made up of mostly people who come to Tot. And I think the next thing is going to Stingrays, is that right? Because we were going to go, but then it snowed last week, and so that got rescheduled.
Which was awesome.
Yeah. Well, so anyways, I think those are all the announcements I have. You should go, you can join the group me for Holy City Life and vote for when they are looking to reschedule the Stingrays hockey game visit. Brian, did you have, before we jump in tonight, a highlight from the snow last week?
Yes, actually I did. So my highlight from the snow was looking out the window and seeing just this blanket of beauty and quiet, because I live downtown, so it's not always quiet, but you could go outside and it was like silent, and you could hear the birds, and then every occasionally you'd get a little bit of sun through the cloud, and would like the snow would like shine, probably because it had a lot of ice in it, but it was beautiful. So yeah, it was just cool and a reminder that sometimes there is beauty that just comes that we had nothing to do with, and it was just a gift.
The quiet was startling to me. So my backyard is right up against I-26, and so it is always just kind of background noise, and it was eerie how quiet it was.
Yeah.
I could sleep very easily. It was nice.
Yeah,
but yeah, it was pretty neat. Our three kids loved being out in the snow, and it reminded me of our time. We lived in Philly for 4 years, and that was a lot of fun to
experience. It reminded me of when I lived in Narnia.
Your hometown. Well, we're excited for the next few Theology on Tuesdays, because we are going to be talking about this book that was given to us called The Defining Decade, Why Your 20s Matter and How to Make the Most of Them Now. And most of our folks here are probably in their 20s, but this is important no matter if you're in your 20s or 30s, whatever. I'm really excited. We're going to spend several weeks talking about various aspects of life in your 20s. But I think we'll try to introduce it. So Meg J., who is she? What is the book kind of about in general?
So Meg J. is a very well-known sociologist and psychotherapist. She did private psychotherapy out on the West Coast and also was teaching in various universities, and then was invited to join probably the most prestigious research institute that deals with marriage and family and all of these kinds of issues that sometimes we talk about in Todd at the University of Virginia. And so she is part of that institute and wrote this book. And a lot of times we'll talk about books in here and we would maybe not say you should really read this book, but we're just going to sort of tell you some of the highlights. Please read this. This book is really amazing.
Has anyone read it? No? Okay. Yes, this is great.
All right. So just in case you didn't know, this book is a publishing phenomenon. It has over 10,000 reviews on Amazon that are all like 4.5 stars and higher. And a lot of them, probably the majority, are from people who are in their 20s. And the great thing about this book is that it's not written for parents of 20-somethings who want to straighten out their kids. It's not written for anyone except for people who are in their 20s. And there's just a tremendous amount of wisdom in it. And part of what I love about it is she's not writing from a Christian perspective, but one of the things that I believe is true that Justin and I have talked about a number of times is that God has hardwired truth into the world, and God has hardwired truth into the way that we are created and what makes for human flourishing. And if you have somebody who is an honest student who is studying what makes for human flourishing, they will often discern a lot of the same principles that are actually in Scripture. So even though she's coming from a secular standpoint, probably 90% of what she says, you can also build a scriptural case for. So that makes it especially fascinating.
Yeah, and I really like, I mean, she talks about in the book how, you know, some of the things she says to 20-somethings are shocking. And she's dealing with data and research, and a lot of that's really, really helpful and just factual. And she says a lot of the people respond when they hear some of this, not with fear of, like, I can't believe you said that, but actually relief. And why didn't somebody tell me this earlier? Yeah. And so that's really our hope. And some of the things we're talking about tonight, we don't agree with absolutely everything that she said, but as you said, there's a lot in here that's really important and really good. And I think it's because we care so much about people in their 20s, like Meg J does, at least she says she does, that it's important to bring some of these things up. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, talking about just the significance of your 20s. We'll get to a little bit of, like, what's the problem that she's diagnosing. But this quote that she says here about, here's the significance, right? You ready? All right. Your 20s matter. 80% of life's most defining moments take place by age 35. 80%. Most defining moments by 35. Your earning power is decided in your first 10 years of work. More than half of us are married, dating, or living with our future partner by age 30. Your brain and your personality change more during your 20s than at any time before or after your 20s. Your social network is about as big as it will ever get. Your defining decade of your 20s coincides with your peak childbearing years. Meanwhile, your 20s are the most uncertain years you'll ever know. I think it's a pretty captivating way. This is just in the foreword. So we're hopefully going to get to work tonight, but there's so...
We would actually like to read the whole book out loud.
There were things. We were talking about it. I was like, oh,
so just be prepared. We'll probably be done about 2 a.m. It's going to be great.
No, we'll get done. We'll be done at 8. But I think that was one of the things that probably resonates with many people, but even the way she just said that, like, there's a lot of even biological realities that most people in their 20s, I don't think, are really thinking about. And if they are, they're uncertain about, okay, what do I do with that? So let's speak a little bit about the, what's the problem that she's addressing with 20-somethings? Is it just the uncertainty, or what's going on? Why does she feel like she needed to write a book like this?
Well, I think for a couple of reasons. One is that she has great empathy for people who are in their 20s and feels like that it is a really difficult time. And it's a really difficult time because a lot of cultural factors that have all sort of happened at once. One of those being dealing with COVID, dealing with all of that. Also dealing with the incredible impact of social media, that is a big thing. But that also there has been this movement in a lot of cultural leaders, if you want to call it that, whether it be journals or politicians or influencers or whatever, who are constantly giving out this message, 30 is the new 20. Or 20 is the new 30.
30 is the new 20. What does she mean by
because
that?
Because what that basically is saying is that you don't really matter when you're in your 20s. That you can kind of blow off your 20s, You can kind of like start your life when you're 30, and that your 20s are just a time to go and get wasted on Upper King Street if you live in Charleston and have fun with your friends. But what Meg Jay, the author, is saying is that is so wrong and unhelpful, and that she goes back and says, really, for the past several hundred years until about 10 years ago, the people in their 20s were considered fully adults, because you are adults. And so now you get all of this sort of you're a pre-adult or
emerging
you're a
adult.
You're an emerging adult. But the fact of the matter is you are an adult. And the exciting thing about the 20s is that from a brain science, and she actually knows about this stuff, from a brain science perspective, there are certain periods in your life where there's a lot of plasticity in your brain, where you have the opportunity to really grow and transform. And the 20s are the second highest out of all of your early childhood, up until you're somebody past my age. The 20s are one of those prime growth times. But what concerns her is that we have sort of dumbed down the experience of the 20s and not encouraged people to use that as a time to grow and to stretch and to go after your goals, but rather sort of a time to check out and just have fun. And that the problem with that is the fun is fun for a little while, and then it starts feeling empty. And then you start feeling lonely, and you have no sense of what your meaning and purpose are. And that ultimately leads to despair.
Yeah. She talks about basically this strange period of development, not quite adult, but also not a child. And that's more or less your 20s is kind of what she's talking about. And there are a number of factors, you mentioned a few of them, as to why that has come about. But it's a time of wandering, and some, I think it was the New York Times called it like the Odyssey period of your life. And that's the, and basically, the thought of like, well, it doesn't, yeah, like you said, it doesn't really matter. It's inconsequential. It's not really going to have that big of an effect. And what she's doing is she actually talks about, it can feel like you're in an ocean where you just don't even know what to do in your 20s. But she says the most heartbreaking thing is talking with the 30-somethings and the 40-somethings who realize that by doing either nothing or just whatever kind of exploration
floating
or wandering, floating,
yeah,
that actually was a decision. To not make decisions was a decision, and it has repercussions. And that's the what was the quote about the midlife crisis? Is not like the post-millennial new life or midlife crisis is not the red sports car. It's when you basically are realizing that you're trying to play catch up both in the workplace, in life, in all these various aspects that
yeah,
we'll talk about.
Because the train left the station and you were not on it.
Compared
yeah.
to some people who went, you know, one of the things she mentioned was, for hundreds of years, people jumped from being sons and daughters to husbands and wives. And I think she means, like, joining the workforce, too, as part of that. I came across one stat that was shocking to me. 1960, the median age, you want to guess, the median age of marriage for men and women.
22?
22 for men, 20 for women. 1960. That was not 300 years ago. That was 60 years ago.
I was alive then.
60. Yeah. Just barely.
Me and the dinosaurs.
And most women had their first child by 21. That was 1960. Now, a lot has happened. Yeah, geez. I think it's a lot of people are like, I can't even fathom that. And that's, I think, something, there's been such a dramatic shift in the reality of the workforce, and the fact that one of the changes that was positive is there are now far more women in the workforce, right? But even that has, I'm fascinated by the end of the book. She talks about how basically if you just pursue a career all of your life, that will have implications for family life too.
Mm-hmm.
And you've said this so many times at Todd, but you can't have it all. And I think that's one of the major themes that's going to stand out in this book.
Yep.
But any other things that you want to mention introducing the book before we jump into it?
Yeah, so I think one of the things that she does that's really helpful is she divides the book basically into a couple of areas. So the first one is around work. The second one is around love and relationships. And then the last one is around body and brain. and that she looks through those different lenses at the 20s. And I think it is profoundly helpful. And one of the things that's great is she's a very gifted psychotherapist, and because she's been at it for a while, she has literally worked with thousands of people in their 20s. And she uses a lot of anecdotes, and she changes people's names, obviously, but real life examples that I think, particularly if you read the book, you will find to be unbelievably relatable. And people are very vulnerable and honest in these comments, and I think it just makes it really helpful.
And it resonated with me, I assume, with you as well. And I mean, we spend a lot of our time ministering to folks in their 20s, and I was like, I can imagine
had these same conversations.
Like, yeah, exactly.
Yes. Yeah.
So, well, vocation, work. That's the first topic we'll talk about. We'll spend maybe 10, 15 minutes talking about it now. What were some of the things that she said that were helpful when it comes to work in your 20s?
So many things. One of the things that she says is that working and getting work figured out is really difficult. And that part of the reason for that is that most of us have been kind of on this train through high school of, you know, taking as many APs as you can so you can get all of your college stuff, so you can get into that right college. And then you've got everything programmed out. You know exactly what courses you have to take to be able to graduate on time. And then you had the mini freak out during COVID where everything went fluey. But then most people figured out how to graduate. But then all of a sudden you get out and there's no next step. There's no one to tell you what the next thing to do is. And so you have to figure out what to do. And one of the things she talks about a lot that Justin and I both have seen so often in talking with people is a lot of people just get paralyzed by how many choices there are. That there's so many things that you could do, and it's very hard to discern what your next step should be. And so sort of trying to figure out what your job, what your work is going to be. And then there also is this confusion in our culture that so many people think my job equals my meaning and purpose.
Right.
And that no job can fulfill your meaning and purpose. It may contribute to it. But if you're looking to your job for all your meaning and purpose, that is never going to satisfy. And so she talks a lot about one of the concepts she brings up is something that's called identity capital, which basically means that she says so many people who are in their 20s feel like they're underemployed. I'm not going to ask you to raise your hand if you feel like you can relate to that. I will tell you the first job that I had when I graduated from law school while I was studying for the bar, I was working for an air filter company that manufactured air filters for commercial establishments. And my job was to take the invoices that were coming in from people that supplied them and put them in different stacks. It was great. I was severely underemployed. I couldn't get a real job yet because I needed to study for the bar. But if I had stayed in that, that would have been like really bad. But she says, you know, part of what happens is that we get paralyzed because we realize that if we start going in one direction, it may shut the door on all these other directions, and we don't want to close any doors, and then we get paralyzed by that. And then there's a whole, do you want to say something before I go into the jam thing?
Yeah, because I think the identity stock, or identity capital, right? That's what it was.
I never explained that.
So well,
please explain that.
I think that's a really, she gives the example of how she's meeting with one of these clients, and this the client is like floundering. She doesn't really know what to do, and her parents actually encouraged a lot of kind of take your 20s and do whatever kind of thing, and she wasn't really sure what direction she was going to go in, and she was thinking about taking just like a job at a local coffee shop or Starbucks or something like that, and she wanted to kind of go maybe in the art world, but and there was one job of like working at a very, very low level entry thing that wasn't even like really paid in digital animation. And she wasn't even really, she was leaning towards the Starbucks coffee job, and that would be kind of cool and low maintenance and all that stuff.
Discounts.
And you get discounts on your coffee, right? And what Meg J ended up saying was like, I really think you should take actually not the Starbucks job, but the one that is more in the direction that you at least think could be a field that you have interest in, that you want to go in. She's like, well, it's not going to be the level that I want, this and that. But it actually, by taking that, she ended up going for it. And by doing that, she had found later on that she ended up in cinematography because somebody found her in that arena. They came by her desk, and then she ended up in the field. Now she's like a successful cinematographer in LA. And what I took from that is like, and she gave her personal example, right? Of like, she worked in Outward Bound. You didn't know when she was going to go to graduate school to become a psychologist. And she said the number one thing that all the professor in interviewing for grad school was they saw Outward Bound on there, which was something that was just totally unique, but it was, that was the identity capital. It was the experiences, it was the things that were unique that kind of make you who you are, whether it's your skills, talents, some things that go on a resume, some things that are just personal hobbies or things that kind of really are meaningful to you. And Outward Bound was one for her. And she said that was by far the number one thing that people talked about, as opposed to my grades in psychology, was what was your experience like in Outward Bound?
Yeah, and that those stories matter. And part of what she says is that it's so easy when you're entering into the working world to feel like I'm just kind of like this blob of stuff and I don't know what I'm supposed to do. But she says, in fact, you are someone who has been molded through a whole series of experiences and academic work and leisure activities and your family and everything else. So there are things about you that are significant that have been molded already, mm-hmm. and that those are part of your identity capital, and that the more that you can lean into those things, particularly if they're things that you find joy in, that you have already had as part of your life, that makes sense. So for example, if you're somebody who played violin when you were in high school and was in orchestra and that sort of thing, that's something to think about. And if you're sort of thinking in the broad terms, it's much better to think, well, what could I do that would be interesting, that was related and could build that skill, versus thinking, I've always thought it would be cool to be an astronaut, but I've never done anything that had anything to do with that. And she said, you know, take the astronaut off the table. Look at where you've already got some investment and things that you enjoy, and focus on those sorts of things.
You got to tell the jam illustration. I thought that was really helpful.
All right, so this is, she's got so many things like this in the book, but one of the things she says is that this whole idea of being paralyzed by choice is real. And especially for your generation, it is real. And there is a fascinating science experiment that they did where they went into, I think it was a Whole Foods, and they set up this bar, you know, where they have like the free sample thing. And they had this thing of 24 different artisanal jam flavors. So it could be black currant or blackberry or Asian blueberry or apricot, you know, all of these different things. And you could try all of them for free. And that when you found the one that you liked, they would give you a coupon that gave you 2/3 off buying a jar of jam. And so, you know, people went to this and they're like, oh, this is so cool, all of these flavors of jam. But very few people actually took the coupon and bought a jar because they couldn't figure out which was their favorite. So then they replicated it, but they reduced it to 6 flavors of jam. And when they did the 6 flavors of jam, exactly the same thing, coupon to get 2/3 off, lots of people actually bought the jam. And in fact, when they tallied everything, 10 times as many people bought the jam after the 6 flavor spread versus the 24 one. And the point that the thing is making is that when there are too many choices, you just get overwhelmed. And that when you've got fewer choices, you are much more likely to actually be able to choose among them wisely.
Yeah, I think that is combining some of that. If you can limit the 24 possible things that you might see yourself doing and really say, all right, what are the 6 that I could realistically see myself doing? that was something that was really helpful for me. I didn't know this right out of college, but I wanted to be a professional golfer for my whole life, pretty much, since I was like four. And I'd gone to college to play golf. That ended going into my senior year, and then I'm going, oh man, I have no idea what I'm going to do with my life. Like, zero clue. And I just kind of intuitively was thinking back over my life. What other things did I actually enjoy doing? What things was I passionate about? And I was like, well, being around people and talking about Jesus seems to be that. So I'm going to try an unpaid internship in youth ministry. And I think my parents probably had their heads fall off when I graduated Duke and said, that's what I want to do. But I took like a, you know, I was working a front desk job at a local golf club so that I can make ends meet, but try that very thing. Mm-hmm. And in doing that, almost instantly I realized, wow, this resonates with what I feel passionate about. I feel like I'm gifted in. But it took reflecting back and actually committing and saying, I'm going to go for it. And then from there, the Lord just seemed to open up ways to this point. Another aspect of work that she talks about that I found really, really helpful was this concept of the strength of your weak ties. We've talked a lot about the importance of quality friendship. And she says, actually, she alludes to like the episode Friends, that show, which is like one of the most popular shows in the world in history. Friends and like The Office, which are all about friendships in the workplace and in your 20s. And she said, we think that most of the consequential decisions in our work come from our friends, our urban tribe, the people that we really love and care about. But these studies, this one study that was done out of I think Boston University and University of Michigan, actually traced over a lifespan what were the most influential people and things, and it was not the strong ties, because those are the people you most likely are to assimilate with, the people who are most like you. It's actually not really your close friends. It's kind of the people on the margins, maybe that phone call you return, maybe somebody you hadn't seen since high school, and that was what led to the place of employment that actually your career path launched from. And that was by far and away the weak ties were the things that influenced you in your career path. That was fascinating to me. It's so counterintuitive. You'd think that it's mainly your friends who are going to help you find that job. But I don't know. I didn't think of it. Did you experience that at all in your
life? Yeah, well, I think there's so much truth to that, because having been sort of on the other side of that back when I was a lawyer in the corporate world and doing lots of hiring, one of the things that she talks about in the book is that so many people, because we live in such a digital age right now, that when people start feeling really frustrated with their work, that what they will do is they will go home in the evening and then they will get on LinkedIn or whatever, and they will like figure out, where can I put in applications? And they'll like send in 50 applications, hoping maybe somebody's going to look at this application and be like, that's the person I need. And, you know, my life is going to change because they're going to come after me. And it doesn't happen. And then you, like, feel even worse. And so she has all of these anecdotes where she says, you know, so many people today say, if I'm going to get a job, I want to get it on my own merits. I don't want anyone's help. Mm-hmm. And she says, the problem with that is just not the way
it works.
Yeah. And she has anecdote after anecdote after anecdote after anecdote from people in their 20s saying, in my workplace where I have this great job that I love, I've asked people and not a single person here got their job from putting an application in. Even all the entry-level people, none of them got a job from that. What they got a job from was somebody they knew somebody here, and that's how it worked. And she said, very often you will meet people who will like give you their business card. That might be a friend of your parents. It might be somebody at church. It might be your friend's mother, you know, all of those kinds of things. And she said, those are the places, those kind of weak ties, where you get something transformational. Because she said, when you're in your urban tribe with your friend group, you're kind of in a self-reinforcing rut. Yeah. And you're all kind of similarly situated. And if you want to get out of that rut, you have to have other relationships. You have to have multi-generational relationships. And one of the other things that we would say is a little bit of a differentiation from what she says is that as Christians, if you are in a friend group You are not looking just to each other if it's a Christian friend group. You are hopefully trying to live under scripture where there's wisdom. But she said the problem in these urban tribes, there isn't any of that. It's just the wisdom of the group. So you get groupthink, and that doesn't lead to anything. There, no change comes from that. So transformation comes from these sort of external weak tie relationships, and that it comes from like actually making the phone call, from actually going and meeting the person. And she gives a great example of someone who says, oh, I saw my dream job online and I was so excited about it, and then I saw, oh, they've closed applications for it, so I just gave up. And Meg says to the girl, well, you should call them. And she was like, well, why should I call them? It's closed. And she's like, no, call them and say, I loved reading about this job. This was fascinating to me. If there's any chance that you're still talking to people, I'd love to talk. Well, she ended up getting the job.
Yeah.
And yeah, that is, there's a whole big emphasis in here on taking initiative, taking responsibility, not letting things happen to you, but making things happen.
Yeah. Personal connection, taking initiative, and that goes a long ways. I don't know, we've got maybe a minute or two more before, and I know there's some other things that you wanted to discuss. The chapter on glory I thought was interesting.
Yeah, so one of the things she contrasts in here, again, this is very scriptural. She says there is a difference between striving to achieve your potential and to use your gifts versus seeking glory, wanting to be the person that, you know, is featured on the front page of the News and Courier, one of the 40 under 40 who are the movers and shakers of Charleston who are going to transform. You know, that, and she doesn't use the scriptural context, but it is so scriptural that we are called as Christians to understand what our gifts are, and then to seek to use those gifts, believing that God made us a particular way for a purpose, and that when we lean into those gifts, we're going to find joy, and God is going to use us and make the world a better place. That is very different from wanting to achieve ego and recognition and big salary numbers. But the problem is we are so conditioned by social media, and she, surprise, surprise, she doesn't like social media very much. Her little epithet for social media is compare and despair. That's what social media does, is it makes you compare up because you look at people that you feel like are better than you, and then you despair because you think you're never going to be there. And that is just so profoundly unhelpful, and that instead we need to be looking at what are the gifts that we have, where do we experience joy, where do we feel like God could use us, and then begin leaning into that.
Yeah. We've talked about ambition before and friendship a lot at Taught, and I think she talks a little bit about that, right? The glory is not for ourselves, but if you had no ambition, and she mentions a few people, and that's the danger in some friend groups in your 20s, is that you're all just kind of wasting away together.
We're chilling.
We're just chilling, yeah. But if you have aspirations, like we talk about the Inklings a lot, C.S. Lewis and Tolkien and those guys who were gathered together as friends, cultivating their gifts, speaking to one another about what gifts they see in the other, and sharpening and honing those skills together. They were going in a direction, and that's so different than many of the friendships that are out there today and just kind of floundering. But as you're aspiring to get to use your gifts and to do something with them, it's not to achieve your own purpose and even identity. This is the Christian component. It's actually to make much of God and to serve the common good. And when you do that, that's a far greater purpose. And you will find that actually your life has meaning and value along the way in doing that. And that's part of the Christian twist on things that I would want to compliment. But it's very much coherent with what she's saying.
Yeah, and just to jump back to Lewis and Tolkien for a minute, one of the things that is so significant about their example is that Lewis, when he was 19, was on the front lines in World War I as an officer in the army, and he got wounded, and he also had a very traumatic experience of a friend who was his underling in his unit, who threw himself in front of a bomb to save Lewis from being killed, and the guy was blown up in front of him. And Lewis went on from that to finish 3 degrees at Oxford, and then became a professor at Oxford while he was still in his 20s. If that were to happen today, one of the things she talks about is we live in such a therapeutic society that if anything bad happens to us, we feel like we've got to spend a lot of time focusing on that thing that was bad and how to cope with it. And I'm not saying that therapy is wrong at all, but you know, just think about what would have happened if Lewis had spent 15, well, let's just say 5 years to be more reasonable, 5 years trying to work through what had happened when he was in the war versus jumping in and trying to move forward with his life.
Yeah, one of the big things I think about, kind of to wrap up, as I read this about work, from a Christian perspective, we're made to work. Work is a positive good.
Yep.
There's a great book by Tim Keller called Every Good Endeavor.
If
you haven't read that, you should read it. I taught a class on it. It's on St. Philip's website if you're curious. But that book talks about, in a way, we're made to work. That's part of the way God created the world, is to be fruitful, multiply, and that's not just procreation, but it's cultivating the world as we see it, relationally, tapping into the skills. Like, God's made each of us, and he's given us gifts to be able to do that, and one another to sharpen each other in that. But too often we can make work, again, going back to the glory, all about our significance. And it's not that, but it is something that we're supposed to do, not for our glory, but for God's glory and the joy and help of others. So I think that, again, very much resonates with the importance she's urging folks to jump in. At least if I could summarize, though, just jump in, take a step in the direction you think, as opposed to just floundering and not actually, taking the initiative to go make that phone call or show up in person and see what can happen.
Yep.
And I think so much, she talks about coincidences, but we believe in a God who's in control of everything. That one person you bumped into, we believe that God is providentially ordering the whole world.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the Christian perspective that I think is important to remember.
Yep.
Any final things you have?
Read the book. This is just the tip of the
iceberg.
There's so much good stuff in here.
Totally.
Yeah.
Let's throw it out. How are we doing on questions?
We have a few, but maybe take a second, and if you have any questions, you can submit those, and we will get started in a second.
I was very disciplined in not reading all of my quotes.
Do y'all have that extra?
Yeah. Here you go.
Yeah, pass it back.
Yeah.
Y'all ready? Okay, first question. How can you balance your vision for your 20s with the reality of how they are? How can I ask God for things in my 20s without trying to, quote, write my own story?
So that's a good question. I think that it is great to ask God for whatever. I don't think that you need to put limits on what you ask God for. But I also think that the whole idea of wanting to write your own story, you have to be careful, because this gets into, you might remember a number of talks ago, we talked about a book that was called Don't Follow Your Heart. And that the idea of that is that our hearts are deceitful. And so I think one of the ways of dealing with that particular issue is, I think if you have, for example, an older and wiser Christian mentor to talk through some of those issues with, that can be really helpful. I think spending some time thinking about what are actually my gifts, that can be really helpful, because if you don't know what your gifts are, you're just kind of out there flailing. And if you don't know what your gifts are, St. Philip's regularly does a spiritual gifts workshop that's really good. Has anybody in here ever done that?
Yeah.
Yeah, so talk to people who've done that. I think they will tell you that it is worthwhile. And that can be very helpful sort of data point in trying to move forward in dealing with those things.
Yeah. I love all sorts of like data and personalities. I found the Clifton Strengths mm-hmm. Finder. Has anybody heard of that before?
Mm-hmm.
Clifton? Yeah, okay, some nods. I think that's neat. It kind of combines a Christian perspective that, you know, it, like 34 different strengths, but it says your top five and the realization that we need one another in the body of Christ. So that's definitely a good way to think about what are my strengths and being able to evaluate that yourself and with others. You know, I took that question slightly differently. I think on the one hand, recognizing your 20s as they are versus, right, in a sense, we are called to try to take action and initiative in writing our own story. You shouldn't follow your heart all the time. The heart is wicked, but you and I, we all have choices that we have to make, and God wants us to
make
not just be paralyzed, but to actually take, I think the hardest thing for most of the 20-somethings I know is just, can you make a decision and follow through on it? And so that is one of the biggest things, I think, in writing your own story. It's better to try, at least do your best, get counsel, do some of these things we're talking about, but make a decision and go in the direction as opposed to just kind of throwing up your hands
yep.
in it. And recognize, you know, there's always going to be a gap in the way that the things just are and what we want and hope for, right? I think relationships, for instance, like I can imagine somebody saying, I really want to be married, but I'm not married. So what do? How do I write? I can't like write my own story in that sense. Well, what you can do is pray. You should pray for that. We believe in a God who answers prayers. He may say not yet, and what you can do is continue to pray, show up, and be intentional. Try to have eyes to see the opportunities. And again, half the battle is at least just stepping out, and maybe it's having a conversation with a person you wouldn't normally. Maybe it's not writing off a certain kind of person that you never imagined being with. Those are the things that, in that specific scenario of like, I want to be married but I'm single, you can take the initiative and start to do some of these things that God may surprise you and you'll find you're made that way. So that's the way I kind of took the question. So what next?
I'm messing up the microphone.
It's all right.
Okay.
Hello. Okay. What advice would you have for those of us in or near our 30s?
So, I think being in or near your 30s, many of these same principles still apply, because if, in some ways, our culture is still treating people who are 30 or in their early 30s as if they're in their 20s. So I think many of these things apply, but I would say a lot of it would boil down to get on with it. To not let yourself get lulled into the idea that you're in this passive state where you can just sort of not do anything. Because the fact of the matter is, and she does such a good job of pointing this out in the book, we think that postponing decisions means that we're postponing decisions. But what she says is postponing decisions is actually making decisions.
Mm-hmm.
That when you put off making the decision, that is in and of itself a choice that is closing doors mm-hmm. all over the place. And so I think that entering into, if you're 30 or in your early 30s or even your late 30s, trying to take the bull by the horns and engage these issues is really important. I think finding a trusted older person, which might be Justin or me, or might be somebody else in your life, to talk through some of these things can be really helpful.
Yeah, we've talked so much about just how important the 20s are, and I think it gets even more important as you get older. You realize, just do the math. Time, you know, we're told in Scripture to number our days.
Yep.
And there are realities that we will bump up against, including the fact that we will die. I think that's one of the things we don't think of. I'm curious. We were talking about this over lunch today. I told you I was going to ask this. But who in here, all right, this may sound random, but who in here has actually seen a dead body? All right. That's
okay,
not,
that's actually good.
We were, I was taking a little bit. I thought it was going to be over or under 50%, but that was actually a decent amount. Confronting our mortality is a really important thing. Jonathan Edwards, when he wrote his resolutions every year, he wanted to remind himself that he of his mortality. And I think that's so counterintuitive today, but the realization that we only have one life to live, we don't know how long it's going to be, but we have nevertheless decisions that will have consequences that will mean that we can't do all the things that we necessarily thought we were going to be able to do. So I forgot the question because I went off on that. But
that was good.
No. There was actually what were we talking
if
about?
If you're in your 30s, what do you do with all this?
Yeah. Okay. Basically, it's really important. What I was saying was you shouldn't fear.
I'm here for you.
Thank you. You shouldn't actually be afraid at just how important everything is. You can trust. My simple statement is don't be afraid. Trust in God. Yet take action. You don't have all of your life.
Yeah, don't be passive.
Just take action today and trust in God. Yeah.
Y'all mentioned a few times sharpening your friends. What's a practical way of practicing this?
That is a great question. So I think part of what that involves is learning how to be a better friend and leaning more into a biblical understanding of what friendship is. And I think part of the issue is that in our culture today, and this is not just with people who are y'all's age, it's people my age too, there's a tremendous amount of what I would call shallow social interaction that passes for friendship. And what we need to do is to learn to ask good questions. If we can learn to ask good questions of our friends and to ask people things that will deal with their hearts, that will make such a big difference. Another thing with that is cultivating relationships and friendships with other people who are committed to trying to follow Jesus. If you are a Christian, you need to be in deep relationship with other people who are committed to following Jesus, and you need to incorporate into your friendship practices that will enable you to go deeper. So if your typical thing is to get together and watch Friends on TV, that is probably not going to be really a way to sharpen your friendship. But if you are choosing to do things like going to worship with your friends and then talking through about what was meaningful to you out of the worship service, engaging with works of literature that you can talk about with your friends, studying scripture together, which you can do over texting. I do that with some friends where we study a book together and we just pick one verse each night and text it to our friend and talk about why that's meaningful to us. That in and of itself will help sharpen your friendship. But I think being intentional and being invested and owning it and saying to your friend, I want to deepen this relationship, I want to make this friendship more meaningful, that will go a long way.
Being explicit and having both parties recognize this is what we want the friendship to be more like, it can be helpful. We did one on Theology on Tap on transforming friendship, that book that actually had a ton of great questions. Encourage you to go back. That was a really practical book of just some really helpful questions to ask in friendships that are really good. One thing I think about is just learning how to tell the truth to each other. Actually observe what is the good that my friend is really captivated by. What are the good things that they are drawn to, that they do? And I'm going to speak the truth and name that and encourage them into those things. And conversely, have the courage to say the truth when they're wasting their time in things that they shouldn't be doing. That is a true friend who's willing to risk maybe hurting, now not bludgeoning you with the truth, but kindly saying, I don't know if that's a really good use of your time. And that's one of the refreshing things about the book is that Meg J does that all the time in her counseling session or whatever it is. But speaking the truth in a kind way can be a really practical way of helping.
And I would also say moving beyond sort of that urban tribe that she talks about in here and building some friendships with people that are different from you, whether it's background-wise or age-wise or whatever, getting a range of different experiences will help sharpen as well. These are really good questions. Yeah.
This is directed towards Brian. Brian, can you talk about your switch from law school to seminary? Did you ever experience feelings of guilt in the midst of this decision?
Oh, wow. That is such a good question. And I actually have to go back earlier because when I was first thinking what my career was going to be, what my work was going to be, I went to college as a piano performance major and thought that my career was going to be touring the world, playing with the great symphonies of the world, and playing Chopin on stage. But sort of the reality that happened with that is I found myself playing in bars a lot with drunk people wanting to sing.
You're the piano man.
Not kind of quite what I had imagined. But I was also really interested in law and historic preservation, so I did that. And law school's hard, and it's expensive. So there was a huge investment in that. And I had a great job. And I'm curious about the guilt part of this question, because there are a couple of different ways I could read that. One would to feel guilty that I had wasted my legal education and all that money by switching to something that was not nearly so lucrative. Or it could be the other way around, that maybe God was calling me and I didn't listen and I went off and did this whole other thing. But I would say, honestly, for me, guilt in either of those directions was not really a thing because I felt very confident that God had led me through all of those things. And part of that is that I was very fortunate through making the decisions on all of those steps to be in really deep and godly fellowship with mature Christian believers who were really well-versed in the Bible, who loved me and who were praying for me. And that made it that much more... I was more willing to step out because of that. And that, I didn't really appreciate it at the time, but looking back on it, that was something that was a huge blessing. But it also, one of the things about having been in several careers, one of the things that has helped me with is to, when I'm trying to counsel people who are younger, so often this feels like the make or break decision of your life. And it's just not.
Right.
It's just not. You know, it may feel like it, but you can change and you can do something radically different, and God might call you to that.
I'm so glad that you brought that up, because I thought of the Rascal Flatts song, "God Bless the Broken Road That Led Me to You."
Yep.
Right? It's cheesy when it's about relationships.
But it's true.
But it's true in the workplace and in any of that. Like, And I think that's one of the things we fear of, like, I've wasted it if I make this wrong decision. But God actually uses all of that to make you into the person he wants you to be.
Yep.
And so there's great freedom in that.
Yep.
What is your favorite memory from your 20s? Oh,
wow. I'm still in my 20s, so...
Justin, don't lie. It's so bad. Oh my goodness, I have so many great memories from my 20s. Obviously one of them was getting married and having our first child, so that was pretty amazing. But one of the other things that was amazing was honestly some travel that we did. One of the things that is sort of weird now is people feel like they have to do all this traveling while they're single. But Jane and I did traveling after we got married, and that was so great because we were building memories together, and we did a really extraordinary trip for 6 weeks one summer, sort of before we thought we were going to start working on having children. And it was just, it was an amazing time.
Yeah. That's similar to that. That was, I would say 26, that was when we ended up, my wife, we had just got married 3 years prior to that, and we ended up going to Philadelphia, where we had no connections, no family, no friends, and that was really, we had both, for the most part, she had been in Charleston her whole life, but going to a different place, married together, and like Philadelphia was very, very different than Charleston, and that was really neat, where we had to learn how to live in a new place, how to live married, how to live with a new child, and that was a fun adventure. I think that was the biggest thing, is I knew I wanted to experience life with this person, and we did the work of making sure that we were heading in the same direction. We asked a lot of the tough questions, but I was like, I just want to live my life and experience all these things in these places with you, and Philadelphia, and figuring out how to be parents, and snow and all, it was a disaster and awesome at the same time, yeah.
Tips on comparing yourself to others who seem more successful in their 20s.
Oh, yes. So I would say there's a really funny, y'all don't know who Bob Newhart is because you're too young, but go home and Google Bob Newhart. This is on YouTube.
He's an elf, right?
Bob Newhart. Yeah. Just
come on. Yeah, thank you. Yes. Yeah, everybody knows
so
Bob Newhart.
Google
what are you talking about?
Bob Newhart, just stop it. Which is a little skit that you will see. And so what I would say partially to that is just stop it. Don't do it. One of the things about that is to realize, particularly if what you're comparing to is the projected image of someone on social media, is that it's not true. That it is a curated image that is only showing the best of things, and that person that has the job that's paying $600,000 a year and that is driving the Maserati and posting pictures of all of that, and they're 25, you're seeing that part, but you're not seeing where they are on call 24/7 and their phone is ringing at 4:30 in the morning for the mergers and acquisitions firm that they're working for, and they have no life and they have no free time and any of those kinds of things. So all of that stuff is very often an illusion. But the other thing that I would say is there's a wonderful scripture verse where Paul is talking and he says, I have learned to be content in whatever circumstance, whether in plenty or in want. And what he's saying is, I have learned to be content, and it doesn't depend on my external circumstances or what anyone else has. It is something that is a matter within my own heart, that I have chosen to focus on the things of God's kingdom. And I think that's part of the antidote to that.
Yeah, that's right. I would concur. Throw out, if it's on the internet, don't give a second thought to it. Like, the closer, so I'm fairly competitive. I like to try to win in all sorts of things. You're always going to find people who are more successful, who are better at things, and who are further along. That's just the way it is. And so what I have found really helpful, in addition to just not trusting whatever is online, but you are going to encounter people who are just better or accomplished,
right,
or further.
Yeah.
And the biggest thing I found that's helpful along those lines is to is actually to thank God for them and what
mm-hmm.
they're good at, and being grateful for the ways that they've actually been able to bless others. And also in contentedness in my, is to take it not just to be grateful for them and to praise God for them, but to thank God for the ways that he's gifted me as well. And I think those are two practices that can be really
mm-hmm.
helpful.
Yeah, gratitude is hugely important
yeah.
in that whole equation.
All right, it is just after 8:30, so we're going to have to call it, I think, at this point. We'll be around. We'll keep the conversation going if you want to hang around. And if your question wasn't asked, you want to ask it, we'll be here. We'll be back in 2 weeks to continue talking about
yes,
this awesome
we've got
book.
Two more sessions on this. Get this book. You will be glad you did.
It's really good. Thanks for coming.